this court, my name is Gary Udishin. I represent Mr. Sandlin in this case. I'd like to begin by just making a couple of comments to put this case in what I believe will be the proper context. This is a allegation of false statement to a bank. That was what Mr. Sandlin was convicted of. It's a no-loss case. The bank didn't lose any money. Nobody lost any money. There's really three parties to this transaction. There's Mr. Sandlin. Excuse me, there's the independent bank of Sherman, and then there's a retired couple in Sherman named the Ricketts. All the Ricketts and independent bank speak highly, have nothing negative to say about Mr. Sandlin and his performance on these activities with this indictment concern. The case was prosecuted by the Justice Department Public Integrity Division. It was not prosecuted by the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of Texas. That's significant when we talk about some of the issues as it develops here. But essentially what we're talking about is a loan that Mr. Sandlin received from the Ricketts, $960,000. And Mr. Sandlin filled out financial statements with the Independent Bank of Sherman to borrow money from them, primarily to get lines of credit, letters of credit, and also some loans later. The financial statement, he did not list the $960,000 loan from the Ricketts on his financial statement. It's important to note, though, that on the same financial statement, it was indicated that Mr. Sandlin, he's a multimillionaire several times over. His financial statement submitted to the bank indicated that he had assets of approximately $20 million with liabilities of just a little over $1 million. So obviously he was a strong borrower. He was a regular customer.
If his financial statement was correct.
Well, yes, sir, that's correct, but nobody contended otherwise.
Well, saying, you know, that's why we have financial statements. They want to know what you have, they want to know what you owe. So, you know, your arguments about the government coming down here from Washington and all of this stuff, why don't you get to the legal issues?
Your Honor, the legal issue is that Mr. Sandlin left that off of his financial statement, but the statute requires that he have done so with the intent to influence the bank to give him the loan. And in this case, all of the evidence shows that he didn't have to fill out a financial statement, that he had sufficient assets to qualify for the loan, and the loan was fully
How do you overcome the very substantial burden you have of showing your challenge to sufficiency of the evidence? A jury found that he did do this with intent. So how do you overcome that? How do you show that, based on our standard of review, that, you know, he should prevail on this? And along that line, did you make a move for judgment of acquittal at the close of the government's case?
There was a move for judgment of acquittal, yes.
Did you try the case?
No, sir, I did.
Did Mr. Sandlin put on proof?
But
when I say Mr. Sandlin put on proof, did Mr. Sandlin offer evidence, whether he testified or somebody else?
He did not testify, and I don't. I believe he did present some evidence.
What do you mean you believe he did? Are you the lawyer in this case?
Yes.
Did you review the record?
Yes.
Did he?
He did not testify, and the testimony that he presented was from the bank officers concerning the loan.
All right, so he did offer evidence.
Yes.
All right, at the close of that, at the close of his case, did he move for judgment of acquittal?
He moved for judgment of acquittal at both points.
All right, thank you. Go ahead now. Tell us how he overcomes then substantial standard of review.
Your Honor, the evidence shows, his burden here, let me back up. The government's burden was to show.
No, your burden is to show, viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict, why a reasonable juror could not have found for the government. Now, how do you show that?
There is no evidence at all to show that he left this loan off in order to influence the bank to give him the loan. There's simply no evidence. The government proved that he left the loan off of his financial statement. That's one element of the 1014 charge. The other element is to influence the bank to give him the loan. And the proof of the element that he left it off is not ipso facto proof of the fact that it was done with the intent to influence the bank.
Well, how would you prove that? He doesn't have to testify. He didn't testify, so he's not going to get on the stand and say, yes, I did, or no, I didn't. So what else did the government have to do? They showed he offered this statement. They show he left off the substantial loan to the Ricketts. What else has the government got to do?
They have to present some evidence to show that he did so with this intent.
And intent to do what?
The intent to cause the bank to give him the loan or to approve his loan applications.
Okay, he was making monthly payments on the Ricketts loan, so this isn't something like some credit card debt from a long time ago that you've forgotten about and nobody's ever pursued or anything like that. He's making monthly payments. He does two financial statements. Can't one draw an inference that he knew about this loan, and so it wasn't just an oversight to leave it off?
Well, Your Honor, even if you draw that inference, that does not prove that he did so with the intent to influence the bank to give him the loan. Because the circumstances of this whole transaction indicate that the bank was going to give him the loan because he had sufficient collateral, the loans were fully collateralized, he was a strong customer of the bank and had a strong financial posture. And that leaving this loan off of his financial statement would not ever have any influence on the bank. So the fact that he left it off and the fact that he should have remembered under the circumstances that the courts referenced doesn't prove the intent in leaving it off.
Okay, well, he did sign, and I realize it's somewhat boilerplate, but he did sign a statement that these statements are intended to be for making a loan and all of that. I mean, he signed the typical boilerplate on that. And so we assume he knows what he's doing when he signs it. He's a sophisticated businessman. He knew about these payments. Again, as Judge Barksdale said, short of a confession, what other evidence do you ever have of someone's intent? People can just be incredibly stupid and mess up a lot in a way that looks intentional, and vice versa. Things can be intentional but look incredibly stupid, and that's what juries do, is they ferret out that difference.
Well, Your Honor, I would suggest that the act itself, under the circumstances of this case, doesn't prove the intent. I understand that in some cases the act itself would prove the intent. I don't think that's invariably true in all cases. I know at least one case that we cited in our brief, United States versus Grossman, where this court reversed based upon an insufficiency of the evidence on some transactions involving the bank, strictly because the government didn't prove the intent.
Okay. Well, what about the fact that he signed the statement that said the above statement, which are submitted to the bank for the purpose of obtaining credit, present a true, complete, and correct statement of my financial condition? If you're spotting that they could infer he knew about the loan and he doesn't list the loan, then he says this is true and correct, isn't that enough at least to support the jury verdict? Maybe not overwhelming evidence, but sufficient.
Well, Your Honor, if this was not a case that required a specific intent, if it wasn't a willfully charged, that you had to show that the government was required to show that the defendant knew he was violating the law and did something in order to violate the law, then that would be a stronger argument. Since this is a specific intent offense, the boilerplate language that says he's submitting a piece of paper in order to obtain credit from the bank, that alone doesn't reach the level of showing that he's willfully.
What are we looking for? So answer Judge Barksdale's original question, which is what would there be? Short of a confession, what would there be that would satisfy you?
Some evidence that would show that this was, that leaving this off would help him get the loan, that leaving it off would be a reason, that he would have a reason to leave it off because that would help him get the loan. I think that's the gist of the offense, is you make a false statement to the bank in order to influence the bank to give you the credit. And if the evidence doesn't show that he has a reason to leave it off in order to get the credit, then that they haven't met the burden of proof on that element of
Well, the problem I have is y'all's alternate theory of motivation is that he was trying to bribe a congressman and didn't want people to know about that. And so that seems to be an exculpatory reason, and I'm missing how that's helpful to you, this bribing the congressman reason.
That's not our theory. That was what the government told the district court. At sentencing, the district court inquired as to why would Mr. Sandlin leave this loan off of his financial statement. The district court was talking in terms of his strong financial standing, his collateral for loans. He said, so the court was saying, why would he just leave this off? You know, he said, I don't understand the reason. And Mr. Sandlin stated that, you know, basically that he forgot, he didn't think he needed to list it. And then the government prosecutor stood up and said, Judge, the reason he left it off was because there's a charge pending in Arizona against Congressman Renzi, and he left it off because some of this money was involved in the transaction with Congressman Renzi, that Mr. Sandlin is also indicted on. It's not Mr. Sandlin's theory. That was the government.
Okay, you seem to be kind of adopting it, but that's fine. If you're not, then if we spot that he didn't forget, what is the reason he'd leave off? He knows about the loan. He signs a thing that says this is true and correct. Give me an innocent explanation for leaving it off.
Well, let me say, first of all, we don't adopt the government's theory about Congressman Renzi, but that's an explanation that they gave the court, and if that's correct, then he's not guilty of this offense because that's a reason other than to influence the bank to grant the credit.
No, it's not. He wanted to obtain the loan. He didn't want to show this loan to Ricketts because if the bank asked him about it, possibly, and we have no way of knowing this or getting into this, but if the bank had said, well, what's this loan to this man Ricketts? He didn't want anybody to know about that loan to Ricketts because that loan, that money, supposedly was being used for this congressman with whom he's being tried out in Oklahoma. So it makes perfect sense if you adopt that theory, but that's just theory. That's just speculation. We're here on what was presented to the jury, and Mr. Sandlin, which was his right, did not take the stand and say, I forgot. And so, you know, you pay your money, you take your chances.
Well, Your Honor, he did not provide an explanation to the jury. That's correct. At the jury trial, the government bore the burden of proof to meet that element of the offense, which is that it was done with the intent to influence the bank.
Did the Ricketts testify at trial?
Yes. The Ricketts testified, now, the bankers testified.
Right.
All of the evidence, there's really basically undisputed evidence about that he was a good customer at the bank, he performed well with the bank, he paid the Ricketts back the money he owed them, that there was no financial reason at all for him to leave this off of the financial statement because he was going to get the loan anyway.
Other than he didn't want the bank to know about it. Now, your government misconduct charge, which you arises out of the statement the government made at sentencing about this Congressman Renzi and et cetera, which you raise on appeal here. Did you move at trial at any point before, during, or after sentencing, after the government made this comment at sentencing? Did you ever file a motion with the district court for reopening the case or dismissing the indictment or something based on the government statement at sentencing?
No, this argument was not raised.
Right. Well, shouldn't that have been raised in district court where the district judge had heard the evidence and such rather than waiting until you get on appeal?
Well, Your Honor, it could have been raised.
Shoulda.
I agree it should have been raised, and the standard on appeal would be more lenient towards us had it been. But I believe that the fact that it wasn't raised doesn't preclude this court from reviewing it under the more onerous standard.
Which would be what?
Plain error standard.
Why not just manifest miscarriage of justice?
Well, Your Honor, I think that's a manifest miscarriage of justice in the context of a plain error. That's one of the prongs of the plain error.
No, that is not one of the prongs of plain error.
Well, Your Honor, it is in my view, in the sense that when the court ultimately reaches the point of deciding whether or not a case should be reversed, the case, how the effect it has on the administration of justice, I believe, is a factor that the court.
Well, that's not plain error, but that's semantics. Go ahead.
Your Honor,
I do want to ask you something quickly because we haven't talked about the sentence at all. I think it is perfectly possible that he could have meant to influence the bank, but in fact the bank wasn't influenced by the financial statement. They threw it in the trash, gave him the money based on they like him or he's got such good credit or whatever. So talk to me about the as a result of prong of the sentencing, about the $1 million loss as a result of the statement.
Your Honor, that 2B1.1 guideline provision that we're talking about on the gross receipts requires that the money obtained, the receipts obtained, be as a result of the offer.
Okay, and so does that mean instead of focusing on his intent, we have to focus on the bank's intent?
I believe that's correct in the sense, on the guilt or innocence phase, it's a question of what his intent is. But the argument we make here is that he received the proceeds and would have received them regardless of the offense he was convicted of, and therefore that he didn't receive these receipts as a result of the offense.
And why didn't you make that argument in the district court?
Uh, Your Honor, I think that essentially the argument that was made, which is essentially that this statute, that this guideline provision didn't apply because there was complete collateral for the loans.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Please, the court. My name is Andrew Lovechuk. I'm here from the Department of Justice, and I tried the case below on behalf of the department. I'll start with the.
Let me ask just for clarification. Justice Department's involved public integrity because of what? Because of the congressman, or?
Yes. Basically, the evidence in this case was uncovered, but because of a lengthy grand jury investigation in the District of Arizona. Based on that, we looked into the series of transactions in Texas, which gave rise to the charges here. We discussed the matter with the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Eastern District of Texas. We worked together with them closely, and specifically Assistant U.S. Attorney Randall Blank. A decision was made that since we had already taken the plunge, if you will, we would go ahead.
So Mr. Sandler would not generally be the target of public integrity's focus from Justice Department. It's the fact that it's the ripples from what's going on in Arizona.
I think that's fair to say. In other words, we do. There are plenty of private citizens who are charged and tried by the public integrity section. Almost invariably, that is because of either some connection with a public official or because of some violation of election law. I will say one of the charges, you know, that we investigated also involved illegal conduit campaign contributions by Mr. Sandlin, and that is the sort of thing we investigate against private individuals.
Well, return to this case. Thanks for the detour.
No problem. I'll touch briefly on the first argument, which was sufficiency of the evidence, and. Essentially, there are several things which, in combination, provide more than sufficient evidence for the jury to conclude that Mr. Sandlin was guilty of the offenses charged. Specifically, as Judge Haynes pointed out, the financial statements themselves require signing that you're doing for the purpose of influencing. Beyond that, here we have multiple financial statements. There were a total of three introduced in evidence, and it was government exhibits 4, 16, and 17. One was signed in March of 2006, one was signed in December of 2006, and one, which was essentially re-signed, it's the exact same document as the one signed in December of 2006, was re-signed in March of 2007. So we have a repeated course of conduct here, in which although things change between the March financial statement and the December financial statement. Nothing has changed in terms of the $1 million ripples.
Let me ask you about the statutory language, and you're using some of it. The false statement must be for the purpose of influencing in any way the action of an institution off it goes on making this credit extension. Seems like it's too influence of the word and the phrase in any way, but doesn't that at least still have a component almost of but for that it's trying to cause something in some marginal way at the very least to occur that otherwise would not occur, as opposed to Judge Barksdale's questions to opposing counsel, that it just to make the situation smoother without having embarrassing questions? And what's the requirement of some sort of causation?
Well, it does require a proof of a subjective purpose, but as Judge Haynes pointed out, rarely we can get direct evidence.
Well, not to my direct evidence. Let's say that the jury was asked, would they have been entitled to be given an instruction by the defendant that if you find that it was not the intent of the defendant by this intentional omission, if you find it's intentional, to cause a loan to be made that otherwise would not be loan, be made, but otherwise just to hide an embarrassing financial transaction, you should acquit. Would that have been a legitimate instruction?
In the context of this, there would have to be evidence to support the instruction. The defense is entitled to an instruction usually on their theory of the case. There has to be some evidence to support that.
But are you accepting the, I'm not saying that's your theory, but is that a proper way to read the statute? Does influence mean a causation relationship?
I believe it does. In other words, it means what's in the, it's the subjective purpose in somebody's mind. In other words, what is the purpose of the person making the statement to influence the action of the bank? So you're looking really, inside someone's head. And so in terms of the causative effect down the road, I'm not sure what the answer is. But I don't think we need to get there. It's, in other words, what did he intend to do, or she intend to do, when the false statement was made? That's the best I can answer.
So we have the influence in any way. You're saying it doesn't have to be sort of your intent that it be the proximate cause. It just can be some sort of contributing cause of some sort.
That's correct.
Kind of a lesser standard than proximate cause.
Exactly, and you don't have to examine it in the context of, well, what would the bank have done anyway? That's a major part of their argument, which was this was no big deal. Now, there are a couple of answers, more than one answer to that. The first is the CDs, which are touted as having secured the loans, were partially funded by the undisclosed Ricketts loan. So almost half of the money that Mr. Sandlin got from the Ricketts was put in independent bank with CDs, which are in turn pledged to support the loan. And trial transcript.
Which loan? The bank loan or the Ricketts loan?
Oh, to support the bank loan.
Okay.
The series of bank
they weren't secure. They weren't pledged to the Ricketts, were they?
No. CDs are pledged to the bank.
All right.
But CDs are in part to the tune of about $400.
No, I understand that.
Yeah. Funded by the Ricketts. Just in the trial testimony on this is transcript pages 322, 345, 351. And that's the testimony of Rudy Ruiz, who was our financial expert. One reason you hide the Ricketts loan is because you don't want an inquiry into, okay, we have this $1 million, where did that wind up? Well, it wound up in the CDs that I'm pledging to you, which may cause further inquiries down the line. Well, what rights do the Ricketts have versus the bank, and so on. That provides a substantial motivation to just leave that to one side and not tell the bank anything about it. another answer is...
of course, the flip side of that is those are CDs with the bank, which the bank was happy to receive. And I assume all of this was argued to the jury about the CDs and why that was really advantageous to the bank and why it was really detrimental to the bank. The jury heard all of this both in evidence and in argument?
That's correct, Your Honor. The jury heard about the CDs, both that they were partially funded from the Ricketts loan, but also that they were there for the bank to take. On the other hand, we were able to elicit evidence that the CDs, by the time you get to 2007, in the course of transactions, the CDs didn't cover the entire indebtedness. We had vacant land on which there was, which was being used to secure.
And was this, as I recall from the briefs, this was another point of contention at trial that he estimated the value of the land as being greater than what the government contends the value of the land was?
Yes, and I think ultimately what it came down to was, as Mr. Brooks testified in his trial testimony, he's the bank president, you have an appraisal, you have land, but if it's vacant land in particular, values fluctuate. The idea that the CDs took care of this thing entirely is simply not true.
And this case was tried in 2008?
It was tried in 2008.
Right, after land values were headed south?
I'm not sure they were as far south as they later got, but
was that pointed out to the jury, the uncertainty of the real estate market?
Well, we didn't argue current history, although it was a jury of people who, some of them were as old as me and remember
the Faulkner deal. Yeah. I was just going to say that's the Eastern District, Rockwall, and that whole area.
Well, and so I didn't certainly try to prejudice the jury with what was happening. shouldn't have been anyway. We believe there was sufficient motivation for Mr. Sandlin to not disclose, because the fact is the regulators only were used to fund the CDs in part. The other issue is the remainder of those funds in the CDs, as we have acknowledged, did come from Congressman Renzi. In order to avoid that detour, the defendant at the before trial filed a motion in limine to keep all of the Arizona evidence out of the case. We had no problem with that. And so Arizona stayed out. But in a way, you know, and this really goes to the misconduct argument, you know, why would you bring this case? Well, in effect, he's accused of, those are illegal proceeds as charged in the Arizona indictment. And in effect, illegal proceeds funded the rest of the CDs that weren't funded by the Ricketts.
And when they moved in limine to exclude the Arizona evidence, as I understand from counsel for defendant, they also did not move to dismiss the indictment for government misconduct, the claim they are now raising for the first time on appeal.
No, neither at trial nor at sentencing.
But they were certainly aware of it, obviously.
Well, they were aware of the connection to Arizona. So, in effect, it's as if you had, let me use a starker analogy, a bank robbery in Arizona. Bank robber comes and deposits his ill-gotten proceeds in independent bank and CDs and uses those to collateralize loans and doesn't, you know, of course we'd bring that case if we needed to, if we wanted to charge him in this district.
So when you raised at sentencing about, Your Honor, at sentencing, Your Honor, the reason Mr. Sandlin didn't want the bank to know about this because this is that money from Sandlin. You were referring to the very motion for which they had moved in limine to exclude the evidence.
Well, it was at evidence at trial. By the time we get to sentencing, you know, the judge did ask. He acknowledged that, you know, it is somewhat unusual to see a no-loss bank fraud case, and we were explaining here's why. You know, there were certainly, in our view, multiple motivations which would lead one to intend to influence the bank by leading that off, one of which was you don't want any inquiry back that leads you back into Arizona.
But did you reference the judge back to the very motion he had granted pre-trial on excluding the evidence?
I don't recall whether I did. I don't believe I did, Your Honor.
Counsel, let me ask, what is your view of what the jury would have had from the government as to a total net worth for the defendant? Your brief, I forget your adjectives, but you're dismissive of the $30 million total that Sandlin argues. Would you say that your evidence was such, you may not have presented this kind of evidence, where the jury would have, from your own evidence, had a certain net worth understanding of Mr. Sandlin's situation?
It would have been hard other than through the financial statements. And so the first financial statement, the subject of the first count, listed his total assets, I believe, around at the $30 million level. By December of 06, that had dropped to, I believe, $15 million or thereabouts. We believe both figures were an exaggeration. But because materiality is not an element of Section 1014, his net worth never became an issue. It was just what they would have seen on the financial statements, but there's nothing that was before them that would have required them to make any finding one way or the other on what his assets were.
I want to be sure I give you a chance to address this as a result of, because I'm very concerned about it. I think on the side of whether he's guilty, we're focused on his intent and the subjectiveness and all of that. We've talked about that. But on the sentencing, the gross receipts as a result of, I'm having trouble coming up with any other definition of as a result of, but again, that it has some causative component on the bank, that the bank, never mind what his intent was, that the bank in fact was caused in some part to do something different as a result of this financial statement. And what evidence do we have of that?
Well, it would have to be a negative inference, which would be, had this loan been properly disclosed, that would have led to, in the ordinary course, a series of inquiries which may or may not have changed the bank's lending decision. But you would have to get to the point where if this loan is disclosed, What questions does the bank ask? We believe that if they were careful bankers, they would have asked questions to the effect that,
but well, isn't all the evidence to the contrary of this carefulness and all this? The bankers all got up and said, we didn't even need this financial statement. It was fully collateralized. We threw it in the trash, in essence. I mean, there's not a lick of evidence that these guys are poring over it, asking questions about loans and so forth. And while I understand that it's sentencing, it's a preponderance of the evidence and a deferential standard of review, don't we have to have something more than just rank speculation to support a conclusion of as a result of?
Well, the financial statement, I think you have sufficient support in that. Financial statements were required.
I thought the banker said they weren't.
Well, at an early point, perhaps not, but by 2007, his indebtedness did require financial statements. The inference would be that if one, the bankers got up and said, we were fully secured. What the bankers didn't know is that essentially this was the proceeds of crime, which had been put in those CDs. Now, when we indicted in Arizona, we didn't pursue those CDs under forfeiture and have the money frozen because we didn't want to hurt the innocent bank. And we were very careful also that we didn't do anything that would hurt the Ricketts. So, but the fact, when they get up and they say, we were fully secure, they are completely ignoring, because they weren't brought into the loop, if you will, the impact of the Arizona investigation.
Okay, let me come at it this way, because I'm not getting where I need to go. Tell me the evidence, either at trial or at sentencing, that supports the conclusion that the money was loaned as a result of these financial statements.
The money was loaned as a result of the false statements because had the Ricketts loan been disclosed, we believe that...
Okay, I'm asking you for the evidence, the testimony, the document, something you can point me to that I can go back and look at and hang my hat on besides your belief.
That $460,000 of the Ricketts loan was used to put in the CDs. And that would have, in our view, for careful bankers, would have caused them...
Okay, what evidence is that these guys were careful? What evidence is it that these guys were making these kinds of inquiries or examining what they did know in the financial statements at all? That's what I'm asking you for.
Right. In other words, if they're, you can't not report that you borrowed money to put in the CD, which you're pledging, and there's a debt out there that corresponds to that. You're always going to have some result down the road which requires you to assume that bankers are going to be reasonable.
Well, that's questionable in the light of the recent banking fiasco, but also it cuts that we want bankers to be more careful. So let me ask you this. Of course, this was a federally insured bank.
Yes.
And I assume federal regulations require certain documentation for loans when you are a federally insured bank. And is one of those regulations that financial statements from borrowers are required?
We did not put on testimony to that. We didn't put on FDIC expert, but Mr. Brooks testified at trial that generally examiners want to see loan or financial statements in the file.
And these are federal bank examiners?
That's correct. Or state bank examiners. Apparently the way it works in Texas is that it's done by state regulators.
Well, was Independent Bank a state bank or a national bank?
It was FDIC insured. I believe it's chartered in Texas, but it remains FDIC insured, so FDIC can come in and examine whenever they want. But one more point on the loss issue. I would go back to the Garvey case, which we cite in the brief. I believe Judge Jones said it very clearly, proceeds means proceeds. I don't think that as a result of language in the guideline should allow one to present testimony from bankers whose relationship is with, you know, necessarily sometimes have personal relationships with defendants, to come in and alter Congress's sentencing scheme because they're willing to come in and say, oh, we would have made these loans anyway. This is no big deal.
Well, then Congress doesn't have to have the as a result of, or the that doesn't have to be in the sentencing guideline, but if it's there, we have to give some meaning to it, don't we?
You do, but I think the use of the proceeds and the fact that one Bending disclosed the loan is evidence, but also say, Mr. Bandinger's testimony at sentencing, there I did ask him about the Arizona case.
I think you're still answering your question. Please wrap up, but answer it.
In Mr. Bandinger's testimony at the sentencing hearing, when he asked about the Arizona case, he said, would you have wanted to know that illegal proceeds funded the CD? And that refers to the remainder of the balance besides $460,000. He said yes. So I think the court can also consider Mr. Bandinger's testimony at sentencing.
Thank you, counsel.
Your Honor, just briefly, on the question of sufficiency, let me take another stab at explaining how I see the review process. The government can prove the intent by circumstantial evidence, and that would normally be the way the intent would be proven. But the circumstances would have to support the inference. And in this case, the circumstances do not support the inference. So the evidence is insufficient to prove that he made a statement or left these loans off of the financial statement for the intent to influence the bank to provide the credit. And I understand on appeal that the court's going to be reviewing this to see if any rational prior fact could have found as the jury found. But if there's simply no evidence to support it and no evidence to even make from a circumstantial standpoint to draw the inference, then the evidence is legally insufficient. And as I said,
how was the jury instructed on? You're not raising any instruction error. How was the jury instructed on this?
They were instructed that it had to be done with the intent to influence the bank to provide the credit. It had to be done knowingly and willfully. So with the definition of willfully given, required that the jury find that the defendant was doing an act in violation of the law, knowing he was violating the law, essentially. And the circumstantial evidence just simply doesn't support that. And when you're talking about the circumstantial evidence and the review on appeal, our position would be that no rational trier of fact could find that because there's no basis with which to make that finding. A couple of comments about the government's attorney's argument. The question, for instance, the question about whether or not he ever had to provide financial statements, there's nothing in the record other than the banker's testimony that he did not have to provide a financial statement at any point. There's no difference.
Well, you had too many negatives in there. Would you say that again?
There's nothing in the record from any witness other than the banker's. The banker said he never had to provide a financial statement.
And that's the only evidence. That's
the
what you're saying. Okay.
And the government's telling the court that at some point he had to provide a financial statement, but there's no evidence of that.
Well, then, so was the banker asked, and why did he provide them?
I don't recall if the banker was asked that specifically. I think I noted in my brief that the record is unclear as to why he ever provided them, since the banker said he didn't need to.
That's a pretty critical point you ought to be able to tell us about.
Well, and there's no evidence as to why he provided them.
Well, but you said you don't recall whether he said that, and I'm saying if you're going to be here arguing a case to us, you're supposed to know the record.
Let me restate that. There is no evidence as to why he provided them. Nobody asked the bankers why he provided them. These bankers that testified said he did not need to provide them. And so the inference is, well, there is no inference because there's no evidence as to why he ever provided them.
Did the bankers testify they had looked at them?
No, the bankers never testified they even looked at them. And the inference from the evidence would be that they didn't look at him. Now, there was testimony at one point that from one of the bankers that Mr. Sandlin asked him if he had enough security for the loans and offered to provide additional security. And so Mr. Sandlin may have just submitted the statements without being asked. There's just simply no evidence concerning that. Concerning the appraisal value of the land, There's no evidence that the land was overvalued. The appraisal was done by a certified appraiser in Arizona that was hired by a bank in Arizona. And the government's argument that the land may have been overappraised is not supported by the evidence in this case. There's no evidence other than...
But land value can go down even if the appraiser was honest at the time. Things can tank quickly, as we've seen.
Well, certainly, but when you're talking about... We're talking about whether the bank was fully collateralized. And you have a valid appraisal, and you have CDs. And that's all you have to go on. There's nothing in the record to indicate that the appraisal was overvalued or was in the process of going down. And I don't think the government's argument is based upon the record in that regard. The final point I'd like to make in that regard is that the financial analyst for the government who testified at trial testified that the bank was always fully collateralized, that between the CDs and the real estate values, the bank had full collateral on these loans, and that was the government financial analyst that testified to that. I suppose that was a witness that they could have had testified that the bank wasn't fully collateralized.
But it's undisputed, isn't it, that the CDs were purchased with part of the Ricketts loan?
Well, that's true. It was purchased with part of that, but that doesn't diminish the fact that the bank was fully collateralized.
Thank you. Thank you both.